Support for NPR comes from MileIQ. The MileIQ app automatically tracks business miles to streamline and maximize deductions or expenses. The MileIQ app is available for download in the App Store and Google Play.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When defense attorney Jerome F. Buting agreed to join Dean Strang as co-counsel for the defense of Stephen A. Avery versus State of Wisconsin, he had no idea that it would become the center of the Netflix documentary sensation Making a Murderer, and that the fight to defend Stephen Avery would spark a national debate about the integrity of our criminal justice system. In his book, Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System, Jerome Buting takes us behind the scenes of that trial and through his years of dealing with America's justice system. It's published by Harper's. I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show. Hello.
Hello.
How long ago did Dean Strang first approach you about joining Stephen Avery's defense team?
Well, it was actually the first day of March 2006.
So you couldn't have imagined that almost 11 years later that your work would be the subject of a 10-hour, 10-episode television documentary.
No, we really didn't. You know, when we agreed to participate in the documentary, we really weren't even that sure if it would ever be completed, much less air, and certainly not the kind of widespread worldwide interest that it garnered.
Mm. Aren't some people concerned about that kind of coverage of a case of this sort?
Well, there's coverage. There's concern, certainly, about the way media covers cases, and that was one of our concerns too.
Although you complain often that prosecutors have much more access to media than defense attorneys,
they do. But nevertheless, we were concerned about whether or not something would air before the trials happened. And so one of the agreements was that nothing would air. When I think back about it, it's kind of silly to. We had no idea what the time frame it really takes to produce and air a documentary. It wasn't going to happen anyway, but that was one of our concerns, that nothing would air until after both Brendan and Stephen Avery's trials were completed, so that there wouldn't be any further pollution of a potential jury pool.
You write that by the age of 43, Stephen Avery had fallen into the gulf between what is preached and what is practiced in America's criminal justice system. Didn't he spend nearly two decades in jail for a crime he hadn't committed?
He did. He spent 18 years in prison for a crime that was, indisputably he was not guilty for.
And so what had led Deputy Sheriff Judy Dvorak to focus on Stephen as the perpetrator of the rape of Penny Bernstein? Is it Bernstein?
Bernstein, yes.
In July 1985.
Well, it's a combination of things. In almost any small town in America, there's always sort of a group of people who are on the wrong side of the tracks that become like the usual suspects for police. They often start picking on them when they're teenagers, and sometimes it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But in this case, it was a little bit more than that, because he had had a confrontation with a friend of hers, and that was his cousin, Sandra Morris. And so they were immediately focusing on him. Her husband was also a deputy sheriff. So,
is it true that Gene Kuska, I guess it is, the sheriff department's sketch artist, actually made a drawing of Stephen Avery from the booking photo instead of from Penny's memory of her attacker?
Well, that was the allegation that the civil rights attorneys were building up, and he denied that and claimed that there was not even any photo that he could have used in the sheriff's department, but in fact they proved there was, and that the booking photo of Stephen Avery from a prior arrest looked very, very much like the sketch he drew.
And didn't Stephen say he was 40 miles away from the crime scene shopping? Did anyone check up on that lead? Because he had evidence of that.
He did. He had he had 16 alibi witnesses, and he had a receipt from a cash register up in this store up in the Green Bay area. And, you know, their investigation consisted of seeing if it was possible to drive that route. And if you did it 10 miles over the limit, speed limit, you physically might have been able to do it, but that would assume that you pick up your wife and kids and leave them in the parking lot, go off, rape somebody, run back to the car, and then drive up to the department store in Green Bay.
So it seems to me that no jury would convict somebody of a crime under those circumstances. Why was he convicted, and what finally cleared him of the rape?
Well, you know, what happened was, it's a question of who you believe. Penny Bernstein, a very nice woman who feels terrible about what happened after the fact, but she was, you know, brutally raped, and she was assaulted, left for dead, and testified, convinced in her own mind, in part because of some suggestion that was planted in her and given to her by the Manitowoc Sheriff's Department. And she was a very compelling witness and a sympathetic witness. And you see, you know, when you look at the wrongful conviction cases, you see somewhere in the neighborhood of 2/3 of them have mistaken eyewitness identification, where jurors think, if somebody says, "I'll never forget that face," and, you know, that's the guy that did it, they believe them.
Were they using DNA evidence at the time?
No, they weren't. This was before the advent of DNA in courts, and that's ultimately what did exonerate Stephen in 2003. Not only was his DNA excluded from crime scene evidence, actual pubic hairs that were found on the victim, but there was a match with a person who not only was in prison and on the sex offender registry, but it turns out had been a suspect in similar offenses in Manitowoc at the very time that this assault occurred.
And yet they hadn't ever considered him as the possible perpetrator.
No, well, there was evidence, in fact, that the Manitowoc City Police, who were the ones who were, they were actually doing surveillance of this guy in the last 10 days before it happened. Twice a day surveillance. They were that suspicious. I mean, there was serious serial type predator behavior going on, and they wanted to catch this guy. Well, the one day that the rape happened, they didn't have the personnel. And once Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department, because this was outside of the city limits, so it was a sheriff's jurisdiction, once they arrested Avery, the chief of the city police, as I recall, approached them and said, "You know, this sounds like the MO of this other guy." And they ignored him and didn't release that to the defense.
I'm speaking with Jerome F. Buting. He has written a book called Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. So how long was Stephen Avery out of prison when he was then accused of committing a murder?
About 2 years. That's it.
Who was the victim?
Teresa Halbach, who was a 25-year-old photographer in the area. She had her own photography studio business, and then she also worked for this Auto Trader magazine, where she would take pictures of people's cars that they would put in for sale.
Did they have stronger evidence against Avery in this case than they had in the previous one?
You know, on the surface, I'd say yes, because they had his physical evidence. They had physical evidence, his blood inside of her vehicle. They had, you know, a key to her that worked her vehicle found in his bedroom. They had her remains, or what they identified as very likely her cremains, in a burn pit. So on the surface, it looked...
On his property.
On his property. Mm-hmm. On the surface, it looked pretty compelling and pretty damning. But once you started peel back the layers and realize how the evidence was discovered and the circumstances in which it was found and who found it, then it became more suspicious.
Do you think that this was partly a payback?
Well, that's where we thought the evidence was leading. And, you know, we didn't go into that kind of a defense, a police frame-up, payback defense, lightly. But the more we kept looking, the same kind of names surfaced. Two higher-up people in the Sheriff's Department, Lieutenant Link and Sergeant Colburn, who had been deposed in his civil lawsuit just three weeks before this happened. They should have recused themselves. They should have had nothing to do with the investigation, but in fact they were the key investigators that found most of the evidence.
A civil lawsuit because he was looking for restitution for having been sent to jail for a crime he hadn't committed.
That's right. He had a $36 million lawsuit, and he was alleging that he was being, that the victim in that case was not only, unfairly suggested that he was the suspect, but also that there was information that they had that it was never turned over to the defense.
How much money did he get?
He ended up settling the case for $400,000, a pittance compared to what he was claiming.
How much did you know about the case before you spoke to Dean about joining the defense?
You know, I knew quite a bit because it was huge publicity in the state of Wisconsin at that point, and I live about 2 hours away, and it was unique and interesting, I guess, to the media because this is the first guy who's been exonerated by, and thankfully to this day, he's still the only person exonerated by DNA, whoever is charged and convicted of something so serious. And so there was a lot of discussion about him and a lot of coverage, and immediately people were suspicious. Well, he shouldn't, the people that he's suing should not be the people who are investigating him now. And the public was told that they were not. And then only later did it come out that, in fact, Manitowoc Sheriff's Department were deeply involved in the investigation.
Well, we hear about a number of wrongful convictions. How atypical was what happened to Stephen Avery? Well, how typical was it?
You know, some parts of what you see in Making a Murderer are atypical. Like I said, the circumstances of being a DNA exoneree certainly are atypical. But a lot of what you see is utterly commonplace, and particularly what you see happen to the 16-year-old nephew, Brendan Dassey. Those interrogation techniques that are employed happen dozens of, if not hundreds of times a day all over the country, in this country, because of the techniques that they use. They're almost universally used in America, even though most of the rest of the English-speaking world no longer employs those techniques because they've been shown to have higher suggestibility, higher risk of false confession. So those types of parts of the investigation that you see in the movie really are sadly very common.
As a defense lawyer, you write, the job entails protecting your client's humanity. How do you do that?
You know, that's the biggest challenge, I think, in this career is that, you know, the courts are overflowing, overburdened with cases. There aren't enough prosecutors, judges, or defense attorneys generally for the kinds of cases and the volume of cases that get charged. And you know, judges are human like anybody else, and they want to run the cases through quickly like it's a assembly line. And, you know, a defense attorney has to say, stop, wait a minute, you got to look at who this is.
What about looking at the police officer involved? In Brooklyn, we had a number of cases involving one police officer, and now they keep on being overturned.
Well, you know, one of the biggest problems I have when you find these wrongful conviction cases is that all too often the police want to say, well, that was just a rogue cop. If there's misconduct, it's just a rogue cop, or it's a rogue crime lab analyst, and you know, that's not typical. And thankfully, it's not typical. But there are many of the flaws in when it comes to police misconduct and crime lab mistakes and eyewitness identification that are systemic, that really should be investigated like we do aircraft crash, when an airliner crashes, and we investigate what is the problem that led to it. And we don't do that enough in this country.
I'm speaking with Jerome F. Buting, who is a shareholder in the law firm of Buting, Williams and Stilling SC, also the recipient of the Fierce Advocate Award for the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, the James Joyce Award from University College Dublin, and the Trinity College Dublin Praises Elite Award, obviously nothing to do with this case that we're talking about, but we are talking about his latest book, which is Illusion of Justice, Inside the Making of a Murderer and America's Broken System. It is published by Harper We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Jerome F. Buting, who's written a book called Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. It's published by Harper's. Now, you write about other cases that you've been involved with. You tell the story of Ralph Armstrong, an innocent man who was convicted of a gruesome rape and murder. You began that defense in 1993.
That's right. And, you know, it's in this book in part because it's emblematic of the same kind of issues, a lot of the same issues that you see in Making a Murderer, but also chronologically, there were big developments, things going on in the Ralph Armstrong case at the same time I was handling Stephen Avery's. And in particular, I got a very important tip in the middle of the trial, the Avery trial, because of somebody who was watching that case online. It was being streamed live online on court TV and different types of media. And so, you know, people after the Making a Murderer documentary came out, people say, well, you know, what a wild case is, you know, that must have been the wildest case of your career. Well, in some respects, yes, it was very unusual, but, you know, here's another example that I had in the office at the same time that has every bit as many twists and turns.
And what happened with Ralph Armstrong? How long did he spend in jail?
He ended up spending 29 years in prison before the case was ultimately dismissed by the judge for prosecutorial misconduct. We had gotten the conviction reversed, and then the state was deciding whether to retry it. And then a bunch of information came out that was really shocking misconduct on the part of the prosecution.
You write that prosecutors sometimes so firmly believe that they have the public interest at heart that they cut corners with the truth and the rigors of due process. Is that what happened with Ralph Armstrong?
You know, very likely. Prosecutors are human, and, you know, most of them have a tendency, particularly in a serious crime like a homicide, they bond with the victim's families. And, you know, I can imagine that maybe years or decades later, it's difficult for them to have to come to the loved ones and say, you know, we made a mistake. Not only did we convict and send the wrong guy to prison, but the real killer of your daughter got off. And
they're also often elected officials, so they want to have a good record. Well, I sent three rapists to prison last year, or two murderers.
Right, right. You know, politics sometimes does enter into it. There's no question.
How often are they held accountable for knowingly distorting the truth?
Almost never. It's very, very difficult. The prosecutors have an immunity, absolute immunity, from a civil rights lawsuit for conduct that they commit while in a prosecutorial function, which basically means, you know, trying a case, preparing a case for trial, and that sort of behavior. If they're investigating or just advising the police how to investigate, then they have a qualified immunity, a little less. But otherwise, you know, in this case, for instance, the prosecutor destroyed evidence.
That's criminal behavior, isn't it?
It should be. It was exculpatory evidence. Two judges found that it was a deliberate violation of the court order and a deliberate, bad faith destruction of evidence. And yet the prosecutor was completely immune from any civil liability because of that conduct.
Did Ralph Armstrong get any restitution?
He just settled his case recently, really within the last month. And, some of it is supposed to be a confidential settlement. There's been, you know, leaks and some information in the Madison, Wisconsin papers that it was somewhere between $1.75 and $2 million, which for 29 years is not a lot of money.
But there was a 60 Minutes report a while back, which they looked at people who had been exonerated, and they point out that in many states, it doesn't matter. You get nothing. They don't even give you a change of clothes and car fare when they let you out of prison, whereas if you're out on parole, they do help you go and then reestablish your life. Is this just because we're embarrassed that we have done this terrible thing to these people?
I think that's part of it. Wisconsin, for instance, when it comes to compensation that comes from the compensation board for wrongful conviction, you're limited to $5,000 a year for a maximum of 5 years, $25,000. Now, if you sue and you can show that there's you get through all of the legal hurdles of immunity and everything else, and you can show that it's more than just a mistake or negligence, you can potentially get more, like Ralph ultimately did. But otherwise, 25, who would agree to go, I'll sit 5 years in prison if you'll pay me $25,000? Nobody.
People have said, I wouldn't stay 5 years in prison for $1 million a year.
That's right.
Back to Stephen Avery, at the very moment in 2006 when you and Dean were discussing his case, another drama was unfolding 135 miles away that involved Brendan
Dassey.
Dassey, who was just 19 or 16 at the time. Who's Brendan Dassey?
Brendan is Stephen Avery's 16-year-old nephew. He was a, I guess you'd say, a partial alibi witness for Steve on the night that he's alleged to have committed these offenses. He denied any responsibility or wrongdoing. For months went by until we believe the police realized that he was like an easy mark that they could apply their interrogation techniques against and ultimately get him to implicate Mr. Avery.
But also confess to the murder of Teresa Halbach.
That's right.
And you're saying that he was kind of influenced to do that? We've heard of a number of false confessions
right.
that police can elicit. It's usually certain kinds of people more likely to do it than others, but he was a 16-year-old kid.
He was not only was he a 16-year-old kid with no experience dealing with police officers, but he was also a low-functioning 16-year-old who had an IQ somewhere around 70. Special ed classes, and you know, one of the problems with the techniques the police use is that, particularly with vulnerable people who are easily suggestible, and then when the police apply leading questions and are feeding facts, as the evidence showed in this case, it's very easy to get people to confess to things that didn't happen, and we know that because there are. In the DNA exonerations where people are 100% cleared, approximately 25% of the time, they falsely confessed.
Were you tempted to take his case as well?
Well, ironically, I was meeting with Dean in his office on the day that the phone rings, and we had been talking for about an hour, and a phone rang, and somebody in the family called to say that Brendan had been arrested, and they say he's confessed. And, you know, we looked at each other and said, well, maybe you should represent Brendan. He's going to need a good lawyer now. But under the rules of ethics, by that point, I was already conflicted out because I had been discussing, you know, with Stephen Avery's lawyer for about an hour. So, but I've often thought, you know, if that phone call had happened an hour earlier, maybe I would have ended up being Brendan Dassey's lawyer.
What is the whole process of being co-counsel like? You'd known Dean for a number of years, about 15 years or so, but is that enough of a guarantee that the two of you are going to work well together?
Well, we had worked together on other cases. So I'd not only known him, but I'd worked with him on other cases, although none of them had gone to trial. But I knew his work style. I knew of him. And to me, I think one of the most important things is that you trust your colleague enough to know that, you know, one of the purposes of having two people on a serious case is you could divide responsibilities. And if you can trust that your colleague is going to do his job and make sure that those areas are covered so you don't have to redo it, that's a big part of it.
And how do you divide responsibilities?
You know, you sit down and you figure out where, you know, what are your interests? What are your strengths? You know, Dean and I complement each other well. I have a particular interest and experience with forensic science.
You studied forensic science.
I did. You know, I've always been interested in focusing on science in the courtroom and how it's used and misused. And Dean is, you know, is a brilliant legal expert, so he ended up taking the lead on a lot of the legal issues that we would argue before trial.
How much does mounting a legal defense in a murder trial of this type cost?
Well, you know, at some point, Dean figured out that we made about $9 an hour defending Stephen Avery in this case. And
Stephen gave Dean's firm $120,000, yours $100,000.
Correct.
Which you say came to $9 an hour for the full defense. Was he using his wrongful conviction money?
That was where it came from, yes. That was all the money he had. After he paid expenses for the civil rights lawyers and that they had incurred, there was, you know, a total of about $240,000 left, and that was divided up. We needed a significant amount of money for experts, investigation, and things of that nature. So it takes a lot more than what we had to be able to mount a really effective defense, but we did the best we could with what we had.
And you had an added handicap. You were recovering from a rare and lethal form of cancer. You look okay, so I guess gotten past that.
I have, and it was, I think I had recovered enough by then, but I hadn't yet gotten I was still getting scans, you know, the sort of arbitrary 5 years. I wasn't more than 5 years out yet, so that was a big concern because this was going to be a very intensive and time-consuming case to have to represent an individual on.
There were three very incriminating pieces of evidence. His blood, as you say, was found in his car. Her remains were found in a burn pit in his backyard, and his vehicle was found in the scrapyard where he worked. On the surface, it seems pretty incriminating. How do you create a scenario for the jury where all that adds up to the possibility of someone else committing the crime and planting evidence?
Well, the judge didn't let us present evidence of other actual named suspects that we thought could have been involved in the case. But we did think that we had evidence that made the discovery, quote-unquote, of the evidence very suspicious, and that the people who discovered most of the important evidence against him had been directly involved in the civil rights lawsuit, in fact, had been deposed just weeks beforehand.
So this is kind of like dropping a gun next to somebody you've just shot and saying that he had the gun, even though he didn't?
Potentially. And you do see that in cases. You know, it's the police planting defense is probably the least favored on the list of defenses that a defense attorney will use. And we only used that defense reluctantly when we saw that the more that we discovered about the evidence, the more it looked like that was where it was pointing.
Well, it obviously didn't make much sense that only 40% of Teresa's remains were in the burn pit. The rest couldn't, 60% of her body couldn't have disappeared. So the only explanation you could have come up with is that they took whatever they could take of the body and moved it to his burn pit?
Right, and the evidence was very clear that her bones were found in at least two different locations. And a third location, bones that were burned the same way that appeared to be a human female pelvis bones about the same age in a quarry some distance away. So our theory was that she had been burned elsewhere and that a burn barrel was used. A burn barrel is just a big 55-gallon drum where they burn rubbish out in the country, and there are a dime a dozen in that area. And that was used as a vessel to scoop up the remains and plant them, dump them onto his property.
How would you explain the blood in his car?
You know, the blood was interesting because Mr. Avery, before he was even arrested, was giving interviews to the media and was saying, you know, they were yelling, Stephen, what about, they say they've got your blood in her car. And he says, you know, if my blood is in her car, it's because they planted it. They're framing me again because I've got this lawsuit. And the prosecution scoffed and said, we didn't have any access to any of his blood. Where are we going to get that?
You write that a question you get asked repeatedly goes, do you really think Stephen Avery is innocent? So not everybody is buying the story.
And that's perfectly all right. I mean, they can have their own opinions on that, you know. I wasn't there at the time that Teresa Halbach was murdered, so I'm not, you know, I'm not God that can say with 100% certainty, but all I know is from my experience, as I look at the evidence, it didn't add up, and it certainly didn't add up to reasonable doubt that Mr. Avery was the perpetrator of this crime.
Critics have argued that making a murderer is good TV but bad for the criminal justice system. Why would that be so?
Well, some people are concerned about the whole idea of true crime as a genre, that it involves real people and real victims. And you know, we have to understand these aren't actors. These are, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this documentary, though, is you get to see how a prosecution like this affects a defendant's mother, and in this case, two mothers, as well as the victim's family that you more often see in the media when someone's loved one is murdered. And so there's concern about whether maybe that's exploiting the tragedies of the victim and the defendant.
And it also, some people feel, undermines our faith in the criminal justice system. Right now, there are many people who are upset that the police seem to be under attack from a number of different quarters.
Well, the problem is there's a handful, a relatively small percentage, thankfully, of bad cops and bad prosecutors, and what they're doing is giving a bad name to everybody else. But when the criminal justice system tries to sweep that under the rug and ignore the problems rather than ferreting them out and creating procedures that will prevent that, then, you know, if people lose faith in the system, they've got a reason that they should lose faith in the system, because it's not working the way our founding fathers ever intended it to work.
Where is Stephen Avery now?
He's still in prison, awaiting. He has a new lawyer who's doing additional scientific testing and hoping that she could come up with some evidence that will allow him to overturn his conviction and either get a new trial or have it dismissed altogether.
Jerome F. Buting's book is Illusion of Justice, Inside Making a Murderer and America's Broken System. It is published by Harper. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.